Greetings, programs, and welcome to Parks and Recreation. I'm your co-host, Doug.
I'm your other co-host, Brandon.
And we have a special guest today, Stephanie Castle. Stephanie, you want to tell the audience a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So I'm a water resources specialist, and when I was at UC Irvine, I did a study on groundwater depletion in the Colorado River Basin, and I believe that's what we will be discussing today.
Yeah, we're covering climate change as a whole and all the different ins and outs that go with that. I thought a good place to start would be the greenhouse effect, which is what this is all based on. Brandon, I know you've been studying this a little bit. What did they explain to you about what the greenhouse effect is?
Well, greenhouse is like a big, giant, like, kind of like a big, giant window thing, and it stores heat for the plants and, like, moisture. So the air is storing heat and
yeah, it works. It works in a similar way, and it actually works based on the nature of light. So your eyeballs can see a certain narrow range of light. That's what we call visible light. But on the other sides of that, there are high wavelength, high frequency lights like ultraviolet, gamma rays, X-rays. And on the low end, there's radio waves. And one of the most important ones for this topic is infrared. Infrared is just below red on visible red on the spectrum, which is why it's called that. It's also the same light that is given off when you think of heat. Like things get hot, they give off infrared light. But not every substance in the universe reacts the same way to all kinds of light. So windows are made of glass. They let visible light in, but they don't let infrared light pass through. Carbon dioxide, methane, other greenhouse gases that get in our atmosphere do the same thing. So even though the visible light from the sun comes through on the way down and hits the Earth, when the Earth radiates that heat back, the heat doesn't get back into space. It hits that greenhouse gas and bounces back down to the Earth, and it stays warm. That's how we keep our planet from turning into a chilly ice ball.
Oh.
So, is that a good enough explanation?
That's a great explanation. Okay. Yeah. Things are heating up. That's for sure.
And if you were on the planet Mercury, for example, we talked about this in our solar system podcast, it doesn't have an atmosphere. So on the day side, it's searing hot. On the night side, it's freezing cold. Because what our atmosphere does, it acts like a blanket. It keeps the heat from radiating to space that we don't want, so it stays nice and warm in the night, doesn't freeze out. Cool?
Mm-hmm.
So the problem then becomes, what if it gets too hot? How much of this stuff do you have to put into the atmosphere before we really start to see a problem? And I guess we're already starting to see that problem.
Yeah, right? So temperatures have been rising over the past century or so more than it ever has in the past. And of course, we've had fluctuations thousands and millions of years ago, but since we've started tracking our temperature in our history and since we've been taking records, it's been the highest that it's ever been.
Well, I think a lot of people who don't believe in, not just climate change, but man, in other words, that we are in fact causing this to happen. Because I think most people will agree that the planet is getting warmer.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to deny. The ice caps are melting. There's all sorts of signs of it. But they would say, well, people aren't causing this to happen because, geez, there's this fluctuation. Temperature goes up and down over a cycle anyway. How does science respond to that?
Well, what I always say is you don't have to believe in climate change. You know, it's fine. You can believe it or you can't. You can believe humans cause climate change to increase and make things move a little faster, or you don't have to. I think the main point is being prepared for if that does happen, and if any dramatic changes happen because of climate change, how are we going to be prepared to deal with them in the future?
Mm-hmm.
And we can't just look the other way and things keep on getting warmer and the ocean keeps on rising and just forget about it. We have to be prepared to adapt.
Well, what is the evidence that would confirm that it is in fact us doing it and not, say, other natural processes?
There's a lot of studies out, and I think 99.999% of scientists believe that humans do cause climate change and global warming. It's our cars that we drive emit more CO2. And so there's a bunch of other mechanisms that have been scientifically proven to, you know, deplete the ozone layer, increase climate change, or continue to warm the planet. So a lot of studies are out there that show that.
Well, for example, when we talk about cycles, if you look over the last, say, million years or so, and we can take samples of the atmosphere that's frozen in ice and glaciers and things like that and find out what our atmosphere was like, say, 100,000 or 200,000, you see it gets warm, it gets cold, we have an ice age, it gets warm. But this most recent spike in warmth is much, much higher and much, much faster than any of the past spikes. Would that be correct?
And that's what a lot of people are attributing to human impacts on climate change.
Isn't it also moving, like, we've been, say, measuring since the Industrial Revolution. So around 1850 is when kind of we really start burning coal and fossil fuels at an enormous rate.
Factories.
Yeah, factories, right, cars. Exactly. All of those inventions came around in around the mid-1800s, and it doesn't seem to be too much of a coincidence that since that time, that's when temperatures have really started to spike. It didn't happen before that. And is there also a way to... I remember reading something about the type of CO2 that's actually in the atmosphere. There's a little bit of a fingerprint on that that is us, as opposed to, say, volcanoes or other processes.
Yeah, so there's different types of particles in a volcanic eruption, which actually cools the planet from the dust that covers the atmosphere after a volcano erupts. So each, you know, CO2 in cars versus volcanic eruptions versus soil sucking in CO2, it's all a different fingerprint on what causes those changes.
And so how do we measure the CO2 that's in our atmosphere to figure out how much of it comes from volcanoes or from us or from other processes?
Weather balloons, and, you know, there's a bunch of different types of technology, satellites that I've been using for the past 5 years to observe Earth from space have really enabled us to be able to look at those differences.
So tell us a little bit about the study that you did.
Okay, so we started looking at the Colorado River Basin. It's pretty much the lifeline of the western U.S. And everyone's seen in the news the dropping levels in Lake Mead. Have you ever been to Lake Mead or Lake Havasu or Lake Powell? Yeah, so really cool spots. But over the past 10, 15 years, we've seen those lake levels drop. And you've seen the growing bathtub ring around Lake Mead. And typically when a region is experiencing drought or low reservoir levels, water managers say, okay, well, if that reservoir is going down, we got to increase our other form of water, which is groundwater. So really the only two sources of water that we have are water in our reservoirs and groundwater. Those are the two types that we can use and humans can drink, we can use for agriculture. And so typically, like I said, when reservoirs are decreasing, we increase our groundwater usage. But it's a lot more difficult to determine what's happening to our water resources underground than it is to go look at a lake and see that the level is low. We don't know how much groundwater we have, so we don't know when we're going to run out. And so what we are able to use is this satellite called GRACE, and it stands for the Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. And it's a dual satellite mission that orbits the Earth and can detect changes in mass. So say, Brandon, it was orbiting you since you were a baby. And each time, each month, it could show that you were growing and getting taller and growing and getting taller each month. And so it could tell you that you were growing in size. So that's what the same way that GRACE works around the Earth. So it can say in a region, if say a region is getting a lot of snow and a lot of water, it can detect that change in mass that is in the water because water is really heavy. So it acts like a giant scale in the sky. So what we can do is combine that data, which looks at all of the water on land, and we can remove the snow or surface water or water stored in soil and get an idea of what's happening with our water underground. And it's the only way to really get a large-scale picture of how groundwater is changing. Say in the Central Valley in California, a lot of the groundwater wells are going down. And so we were able to use that same technology in the Colorado River Basin to show that we've depleted almost 2 underground Lake Meads in the past 9 years or so.
And is there any way to know how much is left based on your findings?
So the GRACE satellite can only tell us how it's changing over time. It can't tell us how much is there. And so we really have no idea how much is there, so we don't know when we're going to run out. So it'd be like drawing blindly from a bank account without knowing how much is in your savings, just continually taking that money out and not being sure when it's going to run out. So it's risky business when we don't know how much is left and when we're going to run out. And when the next drought comes, what if we've already depleted it this time and we don't have that as a backup reserve? And that's the real scary implications of the research we did.
Now, Brandon, you said you covered climate change in school, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. But were there other kind of worldwide effects that they talked about? Not just droughts, but other things that are happening around the planet?
The it'll get hotter.
Sure.
The oceans will rise, glaciers will, like, flood.
Mm-hmm.
Not as much rain, just, like, Tatooine from,
Tatooine.
Like that.
A big desert planet?
Yeah.
Well, thankfully, that horrible outcome is a few centuries away, we hope, but... that is one of the things that people talk about if they're denying climate change, they'll say, geez, we're having this huge blizzard this year. There's a massive blizzard. So isn't that not supposed to happen if the planet is getting warmer? But there's an answer for that. Would you like to cover that? Or?
Yeah. So what we've been finding, and the GRACE satellite shows this as well, it's showing that areas are having more extreme weather. So not all areas are becoming warmer and drier. Some areas, like in Canada and in the northern United States, are actually becoming wetter. And so do you guys know what a Hadley cell is?
No.
So we have Hadley cells that kind of distribute all the moisture around the Earth.
It's an atmospheric phenomenon. It's a, I guess you would call it a set of currents, mm-hmm. or pressures, things like that?
Exactly. Pressure zones that kind of force water to go in certain areas and not in others. And so we're in a very dry zone. We're in a desert zone. And so what we've been seeing, and climate scientists have been seeing, is that those Hadley cells are actually getting a little bit bigger. And so that gap from being able to get some of that moisture is increasing. And so more water is going to the tropic zones, less water is going to the deserts, and more water is going to the high latitude regions. And so places like Missouri, they might be experiencing more floods. They don't know what to do with that water, whereas us here in Southern California and the Western United States, we're going to be experiencing more and prolonged droughts in the future, is right. What's predicted.
So even though there might be a blizzard where, you know, today where you're listening to this podcast, that doesn't mean that the Earth isn't getting warmer just because it's cold right now at your house. It means that, in fact, weather is being destabilized on its way to eventually getting warmer.
Yes.
So... It's all about looking at long-term trends. So they actually covered this on the most recent version of Cosmos, and I thought I can't do any better than Neil deGrasse Tyson. What he did was he had a footage of him walking a dog down a beach, and the dog is on a leash, and of course the dog is doing what dogs do, is it walks back and forth in front of him all over the place, but it's still on the leash. So what the idea is, weather is the dog. It'll move all around from day to day. One day it's hot, next day it's cold. But the person walking the dog and holding the leash is climate. So, yeah, the dog's going to wander all over the place, but only within the zone of the leash. So as the weather gets warmer, things are still going to go up and down, but they're going to trend that way. Make sense?
Yes.
Cool. Anything else they covered in school that you want to talk about?
Well, why do people deny climate change when there's... hard evidence, I guess.
That's a great question.
That is a great question.
That's a political question, mm-hmm. too.
It's a money question.
It is a money question. Because obviously there's a lot of groups that make money off of the internal combustion engine and fossil fuels. And that becomes a problem in science known as bias. Where you have, if you start out to do science and you have a strong interest in the way that the experiment comes out, then you are going to... even if you're not trying to, you know, you're not necessarily sitting there going as you do the science.
I do that.
Well, that makes it easier. But it does, you end up seeing what you want to see in the results. You're ignoring maybe data that you shouldn't ignore. And you're giving too much attention to data that doesn't mean as much as you think it means. And so those types of influences end up corrupting to a degree science. So there's that aspect of it. The other part of it is we like our lifestyle. You know, it's hard to sell people on, hey, don't drive your car anymore because, you know, someday your great-great-grandchildren won't have food to eat. So there's an issue there of how does science convince the public to not only recognize the dangers of climate change, but then take steps to start fixing the problem. And again, people are going to not want to give up the things they like. So you have to find other ways of, you know, okay, people aren't going to give up their cars, but maybe we can invent a car that doesn't pollute the environment as much. Or can we solve this problem another way that people might be more likely to go with? So I hope that answers your question. I mean, there's a lot to that of why people deny it, but
yeah, it's convenient to deny it. It's inconvenient not to. So I think people have a lot of investments, and you look at all around the world. You know, we started the Industrial Revolution here in the United States. We started burning all the coal, but in turn, our economy skyrocketed. And now some of the other developing countries like China, who are trying to compete with us, are still doing that type of production that's really harming the environment. So us in the United States, is it right for us to say, no, you shouldn't do that because that's harming the environment for everyone?
Because we sure got our chance to do it.
Because we already did it. So it's a tricky question. But I think the science speaks for itself, and people can either turn their backs on it or try and be revolutionary and make a car that doesn't pollute. So.
Right. And science is, it's complex too. So it's not easy for everybody to understand it. And sometimes, we'll be talking about this in a little bit, but there was a story that got around called ClimateGate, and the story was that some of the data that showed the planet had been warming was supposedly had been altered or wasn't reliable data. So therefore, everyone who was had an interest in denying climate change went, hey, there it is, all the science is bad, throw it all out the window. But that's not how science really works. One, if there is hard data that shows, in fact, the earlier assumptions were wrong, then science says, yes, do throw all that out the window. That's the great thing about science, is if you find a place where you are wrong and you can prove that you were wrong, then you have to change course, right? We prove that the sun doesn't go around the Earth goes around the sun, okay, we'll follow that lead. But that doesn't mean every time you find something that seems to contradict what you already had, you immediately throw everything out and start over. You have to figure out, is this new piece of data, contradictory data that I'm getting, is it in fact valid? Or is this particular piece of data invalid for some reason? Does the scope of this data not affect as much as I think it does? So in the case of ClimateGate, I guess, Stephanie, you can kind of talk a little more about what actually, where that came from and why it's wrong.
Yeah, and so it's just one instance where someone found something that might be a little bit off. It's one way of measuring how the climate is changing. And so this was a temperature record that may have been altered or may have been incorrect. But if you look at tree ring records, we had mentioned ice core records, they're all still saying that we're in the warmest period in a very long time, and the rapid change in our temperature increases has never, ever happened before.
Not this fast.
Not this fast. And so, yes, one study might have had a glitch and something might have been wrong, but that doesn't negate all the other studies that are still saying the same thing.
And the hard data is still out there. Like you said, the tree rings, anybody else can go and double check and measure these things. They can take samples. And that's kind of the great thing about science, too, is it's kind of democratic. Everybody has access to experiments. In fact, you published a study, the study that you've been talking about. What that means in terms of publishing a study, it means that other scientists can go look at your data or gather the same data again, and they should get the exact same result. That's what makes it a publishable or reliable piece of science, right?
Yes, and it's peer-reviewed by other scientists, and they have to sign off on it. So if it's a very long and tedious process to make everyone happy, but once it's published, it's legitimate.
Right. That makes it part of the mainstream accepted scientific law. Make sense?
Yes.
Cool. What other stuff do you want to cover about climate change? We've got the whole wide world here.
Well, will the ocean really flood if the caps do melt faster or keep on melting?
Yeah, I mean, think of it this way. It's like if you have a glass of water and you put ice cubes in it and those ice cubes melt, the water level is going to go up. It's the same thing. It's just a bigger glass and bigger ice cubes. It doesn't mean the entire land surface of the Earth is going to go away. There's not enough ice in the poles to completely submerge the entire Earth underwater. But you would see a significant, you know, this house where we're sitting in now might be underwater if they continue to.
Wasn't it once?
Yeah, I'm sure this whole area, the whole state of California was under the water at some point.
So it could happen again.
Sure. But that happened much slower as part of continental drift and other forces. Here we're talking about, in basically in the course of your lifetime, you might start to see these kinds of effects where even if the ocean only goes up, let's say, 8 feet, well, think about the entire island of Manhattan. Like, there's no hills on Manhattan. The whole thing is...
People, you know, in Florida.
Yeah, yeah. Florida's going to go away.
Do you know what the ice sheets are, where they are?
North Pole, South Pole.
Yeah, yeah. So Greenland. Greenland is a major one, and we've been able to use that gray satellite that I was talking about before. So that's losing a lot of ice mass, and that's going away into the ocean. So the gray satellite can actually track how much mass has been lost and how much ice has actually gone into the ocean.
And I think one of the interesting things I found out just recently in researching for this podcast was the oceans themselves, to some degree, are helping our temperature not rise as fast as it might. And I was starting to figure out, is that because, in fact, essentially we're dumping a lot of ice into the ocean? So temporarily, the ocean's getting chilled out, but that effect will wear off, right?
I think so, yeah. The ocean moves a lot slower in those terms. So if a big ice mass is going into the ocean and cooling it, it'll be, it'll eventually disperse and, you know, go back to normal. So,
and we're also screwing up the currents to a degree too that carry that cold, either cold or warm water, wherever they're normally supposed to go. They are now, those currents are getting altered. True.
Yeah. And then if you think of El Nino, which we are supposed to be in a weakened El Nino right now, and usually they happen every 6 to 8 years.
What is an El Nino for our listeners?
Okay, so an El Nino is when the wind patterns across the world change. And so have you ever read about Peru or South America?
No.
Okay, so there's like Peru and Ecuador, all those regions over there, and they depend on the winds coming from a certain direction, blowing at a certain speed, to take the water on the ocean at the beach and move it deeper or farther offshore. And so water from the deeper nutrient-rich zones of the ocean can come up and supply phytoplankton for fishing. And so when El Nino happens, those winds stop moving so fast. They totally stop. So that water can't move off the beach, and that nutrient-rich water can't come up to the shore for fishing, and so their economy really suffers. So El Nino is this phenomenon where things start changing, the water gets warmer up here, and the tides change, and
yeah, it's basically a temperature cycle that it primarily affects, I guess, the west coast of North and South America, right?
Yes.
So when that gets, I think it's, what is it, a 9-year cycle or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, once every 9 years this happens. But like Stephanie said, it doesn't just affect a nice day at the beach. It actually affects the life cycles of fish in the ocean and the economies of the countries that depend on that fishing. And because of climate change, now that's, we're kind of, what's happening to it?
So we've expected an El Nino. So up in the western U.S., we really like El Nino because it brings more moisture and more cold fronts to our mountains. So the Sierra Nevada mountains and the Rocky Mountains is where we get most of our snowpack and most of our water. That's what we depend on. And so when El Nino happens, that those areas get a lot more water. They get a lot more snow. And so we've been praying for El Nino to happen up here. And this year we're supposed to be in one, but it's a lot weaker. So I don't know if that could be because of climate change and because of some of that ice going into the water and messing things up. So that's just an example that we really want it. We haven't gotten a wet year in a long time, and we were hoping that this year would be a lot better.
With the ice going in the water going up, if the world's getting hotter, can it evaporate and that even out?
Well, the problem is that, yes, more heat will mean more evaporated water, which will put more moisture into the air, but water actually is a greenhouse gas, too.
Water vapor. It's the worst greenhouse gas, even worse than CO2.
So we need clouds. They bring rain around, and they help out, and they do a lot of things, but too much of it is going to get even hotter. So a runaway greenhouse effect, which is what you see on like the planet Venus. Thankfully, our planet can never get quite that bad, but it can get pretty bad. Those gases seep out into the atmosphere. It gets hotter. Well, what does that do? It heats things up more. So more gas gets released into the atmosphere, which makes it hotter, and it just keeps snowballing until it gets worse and worse and worse. So that is something we need to be concerned about too, although that's a little farther in the future.
Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to monitor clouds. That's one of the portions of the IPCC report that is the most difficult. So clouds and water actually are the two portions of that report that kind of tracks how the climate is changing. I think it's every 5 or 10 years. And so clouds are very difficult to monitor. And so it'd be great if we could put more money into research on how to research our clouds and how that affects us. So say there's a lot of clouds in the sky, it's going to be warmer because that's going to keep the heat in, and it'll be warmer that way.
Did you talk in your class about the kinds of things that people can do to help, you know, take care of the environment?
Well, no? I heard turn off your lights every here and there, but if you do candles are just as bad as what I've heard, like the toxic on the...
In terms of the gases that a candle releases, yeah, when it burns?
Yeah, so I heard that's almost just as bad.
I would doubt that. I think a bonfire wouldn't be great, but I think a candle isn't too bad.
Yeah.
Leaving the lights on is... Yeah, that's really any little thing you can do like that. If you're not in a room anymore, turn off the lights. You don't need to leave things running or all the time. And it's not a lot of electricity that it takes to run our lights. It really isn't. But we're talking about the aggregate, right? Not just one person doing it, but there's 300 million people in the United States alone. So if everybody did it...
For 1 hour a year.
Well, even more than that. I mean, just make a habit out of it. You know, you leave a room, you turn off the lights...
Oh, I'm the worst.
Yeah,
I always get yelled at.
Yeah, we're all bad at these things. But the more you can do to say, you know, even these little things, they all start to add up, especially in terms of water conservation.
Yeah, do you know where our energy comes from?
The windmills?
Windmills, that's one source.
That's one good one.
Yeah, and another one is hydropower. So you know how I was talking about Lake Mead? The Hoover Dam is on Lake Mead, and that produces half of the electricity here in Southern California. And remember how I was saying that those Lake Mead water levels were going down? So if they reach a certain point and we're about 10 feet away from that point, then Hoover Dam will be unable to produce electricity. And so we will lose half of our energy supply here.
Right.
So it's all tied together. Energy, water, we could get into food. They all depend on each other in some way.
And we produce our energy in a bunch of different ways. Yes, windmills are one way, and they're actually one of the best ways. They don't produce a ton of energy, but it's free energy. It's just wind that we just absorb the kinetic energy that wind produces. Solar is another one that's, again, not particularly efficient, but it is free.
You see a lot of people installing solar panels on their roofs now.
Yep. Yeah. And that's a good way to help. That helps. You're getting free energy from the sun every day. But the bulk of our energy comes from things like power plants, coal power plants.
Which gives gas in the air.
Right. Now, nuclear plants don't produce greenhouse gases, which is good. They do produce nuclear waste, which is bad. But in terms of our environment right now, actually, nuclear is probably a safer way to go. We can take that small amount of nuclear waste and store it safely, as opposed to releasing tons and tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. But they're not popular because there have been a few nuclear disasters in the recent past. There was Chernobyl, which was a Russian plant in the 80s that went kablooey. There was Three Mile Island, which was it's on the East Coast. And that one in the late 70s almost had a disaster. They were able to stop it at the last second. And then not too long, I think this happened during your lesson, was Fukushima, which was a Japanese nuclear power plant that... not only had a meltdown, but it really showed how bad it could be. It was caused by an earthquake, and then you had all of this radioactive material released into the atmosphere. There people were even worried here on the west coast of the United States that they could be exposed to some of it. So nuclear is a safe energy in terms of greenhouse emissions if you can harness it safely, and that's a big if that a lot of people have trouble with. So,
and if the climate is changing and sea level is rising, then... you know, you really have to think about where you're going to put a nuclear power plant before you just go plop one somewhere.
Right.
And what about Japan? Sorry, off topic a little bit. The Japan tidal wave that came?
Oh, the tsunami.
The tsunami, yeah.
Yeah.
And so didn't that hit a power plant? And then a lot of the nuclear waste was released into the ocean, and everyone here in California was worried about our fish.
Right.
Being contaminated.
Yeah, there was a tidal wave that went along with that earthquake and the meltdown, and that unfortunately helped spread this radioactive matter around. So it's, again, if we could totally get a handle on a nuclear plant and make sure it was 100% meltdown proof, it's a good way to go. There's other sources of energy we haven't figured out how to tap yet, like geothermal energy, mm-hmm. which is basically the heat that's inside the earth that comes out in a volcano, like magma. That heat energy can be used for stuff. The problem is it's, you know, 50 miles down through solid rock to get to it. But if we could find a way to harness that, that's another readily available, cheap, free energy form out there. So we're hoping that over the next few decades, there are some real innovations in how we generate our electricity, because that would, if we could find easier ways to generate lots of electricity for people from what we call renewable energy, like wind and the sun, that we don't have to pay for and is always going to be there, you can't do much better than that. It's free. It's everywhere.
Why can't you just go print some more money?
I ask myself that every day.
One, it's illegal.
Why can't the government do that?
Well, then your government. Well, unfortunately, we're getting really off topic, but for economics, but it would cause something called inflation. In other words, let's say
won't be valued.
It won't be worth it because everyone will have a ton of it. Anything has value because it is scarce, right? You can't get it everywhere, so that's what makes it special. Otherwise, you'd have to have a wallet that was a wheelbarrow and just carry these things down. All right, I'm going to pay $2 million for a movie ticket. But the problem is, if you inflate the currency like that, then the price of everything just goes up correspondingly. So that's why I like when your grandparents tell you, hey, when I used to go to the movies, it was, you know, 25 cents for a double feature. That's true, but people weren't making as much money then either. So everything kind of goes up roughly the same. Anyway, getting back to the environment, because we can talk about money, I guess, on another podcast, but you mentioned agriculture a while ago. I think that's an important component here, too.
Oh, especially on the western United States, we use about 80% of our water on agriculture. And so when we're thinking about drought and trying to conserve, that's kind of the big elephant in the room. But we also, in the Central Valley here in California, we produce 20% of the foods nation, and also a lot of food for other international nations as well. So when we're talking about trying to conserve water, we got to do it. We got to talk about agriculture, and a lot of regions in the western United States, they're getting only 5% of their normal surface water allocations. So the only solution for farmers is to continually increase pumping groundwater, and a lot of groundwater wells throughout California have been reported to be going dry, and so they don't have that backup, and so they can't put food on their own family's table, and they're not able to produce for the rest of the nation as well. So it's not just a local problem, it's really a national and beyond problem.
Well, is the amount of water that we're putting into agriculture, or actually it's not the amount, but I guess the method that we're using, is just a lot of this water getting wasted?
Yeah, so a lot of crops still use a type of irrigation called flood irrigation, where you basically flood your crops, and some of it the plants and the food uses, others it evaporates, others it seeps down into the ground. We're finding that a lot more of that water is actually evaporating and then moving somewhere else. And so it's really, you're paying for this water, but you're not using it, and you're kind of wasting it.
We're just tossing it out. Yeah. How much of it is getting wasted through that net?
I couldn't be sure. Mm-hmm. I know a lot more farmers are switching to drip irrigation, so you just have a lot more pipelines putting the water directly on the crop instead of flooding the whole area. And I think that's definitely been successful in some regions, but a lot of people are still using flood irrigation.
Well, I think when we talk about wasting water, we were talking about things you could do around your house, just you as a regular old citizen can do to help. Sure, taking a shorter shower, and
you should tell it to my brother. He takes 45-minute showers.
Some people just get spaced out in the shower. Like, they just go in there, and all of a sudden it's warm and steamy, and just daydreaming takes over. You can definitely set hard time limits, because, you know, it doesn't take that long to just grab a bar of soap, sud yourself up, rinse yourself off, and get out. So that's one thing you can do.
Why not use salt water for that?
Then you're not really clean.
You're not really clean, unfortunately.
Doesn't
yeah.
salt clean you out? No?
It scours you clean, I suppose. It kind of scrapes your skin off. That would not be... Try next time you get out of the ocean, see how clean you feel. So we can use salt water for certain things. There may be ways that we can use salt water, but the problem with using salt water is that although there is a lot of it, you can only use it if you live on the coast. So if you're in Nebraska and you can think of some way that salt water would be a great substitute, that's fine. You just got to drop a pipeline 1,500 miles to the nearest ocean.
There goes back to money.
Yeah, well, yeah. And that's just not just money. I mean, there's also an efficiency issue here. Like, it's not just that we want to come up with a solution. We want to come up with a good solution. And sometimes if it's, you know, unnecessarily complicated, it means it's, one, yes, very expensive and hard to complete, and two, probably the more complicated you make something, the more likely it is to break, right? It's more parts to fail, more things to go wrong. In fact, pipelines have been an issue for a long time, not just for salt water, but more for oil. There's an issue right now going on up in Alaska. There's a lot of talk in the government about building an oil pipeline, and that's very controversial, too. Not so much for a climate change perspective, because it's not going to produce extra CO2 gas. We're just pulling oil out of the ground and moving it. But if the pipe were to, say, burst, you have a different kind of environmental problem, and not one that affects our greenhouse gases, but one that just kills wildlife and makes our environment gross generally in the area.
One thing my science teacher said, this is not really off topic, but if we don't have enough water, then it's harder for us to, like, farm animals. And if it's harder for us to farm animals, it's bad, but, like, we might have to start eating, like, for protein, bugs.
Yeah, I don't know about eating bugs, but we can probably move on to nuts you can get protein from, or soybeans.
Tofu.
The issue is, let's say you want to eat beef, right? Well, a cow is a big animal, and it eats a lot. And I don't have, I wish I had this. I've seen a great chart that kind of shows how many crops you have to grow to feed one cow all the way to adulthood when you can slaughter it and make hamburgers out of it. And it's enormous. If you took all of those crops and instead of using them to feed one giant animal, use them to feed a bunch of people, you could actually stretch that a lot farther. And again, cows themselves create a lot of greenhouse gases.
Yeah.
I mean,
they poop, it goes in the water.
Again, in the air. Yeah, that's bad too.
When cows have, they are... Livestock is one of the largest crop. If you consider that agriculture, that's the largest water user. And so those crops that we grow to feed them, they're called alfalfa. And we have a lot of alfalfa, but it takes a lot of water to grow it. And we're growing it in the desert. So right. Same thing with cotton. Cotton takes a lot of water, but we're still growing it. So there's been discussion about trying to rotate those crops out and grow something that takes less water to grow.
Sugar is another one. Sugar is an extremely thirsty crop, but fortunately for that, it's usually grown in wet tropical environments where they can handle it. If you were to try to grow sugar cane around here, it would be very, very difficult.
Okay.
But yeah, like Stephanie said, you know, let's say, well, we use cotton to make a lot of fabric for not just clothes, but lots of applications. If we can start figuring out ways to make those things out of less quote unquote thirsty crops, then we can save a whole lot of water. If we can find things to feed livestock, I mean, first of all, the livestock themselves just drink a lot of water because they're animals, but then they're eating all of these crops that also need a lot of water. And finding ways to just reduce our overall use of water means that more of it will be there in the ground for us to use later.
Yeah.
It's just about managing our resources responsibly. For a long time, it just felt like these resources were endless. And sort of like you said, we're starting to get to a point where we can't tell how much money's left in the bank account, but we know we're spending a lot.
Exactly.
And we can't go broke, because if we do, then the disaster would be just complete collapse of civilization.
There's a phrase that I really like that's called embedded water. And so it's kind of a mentality of thinking that water's in everything. Water's in that soda can that you just took a sip out of. Water's in your t-shirt. Water's in my glass of wine that I have each night. Water's in your hamburger. So it takes a lot of water for us to enjoy all of these things. And so if we can realize how much water takes, if there's a lot of water that goes into one thing, maybe we cut that out once a week. And so meat and dairy and milk, those all take a lot of water. So maybe if we cut that out of our diets, maybe once or twice a week, then you're doing a part. So maybe tell your brother, okay, if you want to take your 45-minute shower, that's fine. Maybe try and not eat so many hamburgers or have some milk, you know, do something that takes less water.
Sure, because we're not going to be bringing in any new water anytime soon. The only option there is trying to lasso a comet, which is a very difficult and dangerous thing to do.
Fun idea, though.
It's a cool idea.
What if they put buckets under the the melting ice caps, get the buckets, bring them back.
It's a lot of buckets. Yeah. That's a big ice cap.
That'd be a fun study to do, though. How many buckets do you need?
To save the entire ice cap. Well, the bigger issue is not so much to save the water from the ice cap. It's we want the water to stay in the ice cap. One of the things the ice cap is white. And I'm sure everybody knows when you wear white clothing, you're cooler. Because white things, the reason they're white is because all of the light that hits them is bouncing off back into your eyes.
And the
white,
black traps.
It's the opposite, right? So it's holding on to all of that. Well, the more white there is on the surface of the Earth, that increases the Earth's, the scientific word is albedo, which is how shiny or reflective the Earth is. So, for example, our moon has a low albedo. It's kind of shiny because it's close to the sun, but if you're actually to get up close, you can see it's kind of a dingy gray color. So the Earth is actually pretty dark because of our oceans. Our oceans are dark blue, so they hold a lot of heat. Our ice caps reflect a lot of light, and that helps cool things off. But as the ice caps shrink, that's less reflective surface, and that means more heat. So it's important to kind of keep those ice caps where they are. They're doing a lot of good things. Plus, they're also holding on to a lot of greenhouse gases. There's a lot of methane that is trapped in what's called permafrost. Permafrost are parts of the Earth where there's ice underneath the surface of the Earth, like under the soil, and it stays, like in Siberia in Russia. It's been frozen there for millions of years. But underneath it is lots of methane produced by biological microbes and things like that over the course of millions of years. It's all trapped in the ice. But if we let it out, now we're letting more greenhouse gases into the air, and now it gets warmer, and more of it melts, and more of this stuff gets out. In fact, was it last year or the year before, this giant sinkhole opened up in Siberia, and people were wondering what this was, and we think it's exactly that. It's a hole in the permafrost caused by global warming that just releases all of this nasty stuff into the air, and the more of those form, that's another sign that things are not going well for the planet. So, to answer your question in a long way, we could probably save a lot of the water from the ice caps, or we could find ways to move that water around, but what we really want is for it to stay frozen where it is.
Big wall. You could make a big wall.
The Game of Thrones solution, the giant ice wall. Unfortunately, water is very good at seeping around things. You can make a small thing to enclose water, like a bathtub or a jar, but as you'll find out someday when you hopefully own your own house, you'll find out there's places where water is seeping through tiny little cracks, and like it just knows how. It's a tiny molecule. It knows how to get into any hole and cause damage. So you could, even if you wanted to build a great wall of Antarctica, that water's getting through. Plus, it can evaporate and go over the wall.
Yeah. Winter is not coming here.
Unfortunately. Although there's a lot of good reasons to be glad we're not in Westeros, aside from the weather.
Yes.
Any other stuff you want to talk about for climate change?
I mean, I think there's a lot more things, but that has, there's a lot to cover, but, I mean...
Stephanie, is something important you think we should, our listeners should know?
Yeah, I think, like I said before, how I began, you don't have to believe in climate change. I think everyone in this room does, and that humans do have an impact on it. But whether you do or don't, we got to be prepared for whatever's coming. And I think we need to be ready to adapt. And how we're living now in terms of water and our surface water and groundwater isn't sustainable. Have you heard of that word before?
Yeah.
Sustainable? So we really need to figure out a way to, here in California specifically, get back to our more natural state of things. Golf courses and our green lawns, that isn't natural. That's not sustainable here anymore if things continue to go. So people are going to need to be able to be open to change and being able to live more within our means in terms of our water.
Right. There was maybe I'll end with this. There was a great editorial cartoon that I saw on climate change, and this one's made the rounds, and it shows a symposium, and there's a professor up at a chalkboard, and on the chalkboard it says, clean water and, sustainable food and all of these wonderful things that we need to accomplish. And the guy in the audience stands up and says, "What if global warming is a myth and we end up making a better planet for nothing?" I think even if you don't believe in it, there are... it's still a good idea to protect our environment. We only have the one planet.
For now.
And for a very long time. There's people talking about moving to Mars, but realistically speaking, we would have to turn Mars into Earth. It's a lot easier to probably keep Earth the way it is than it is to try and transform another planet for us to live on. And yes, we will need to solve that problem in a billion years, but we just got to get through the next millennium.
Amen.
Yeah. So anyway, I really want to thank you for coming on and doing the podcast, Stephanie. It means a lot to us. Is there a way that if you have a Twitter handle or something you want to plug?
Yeah, sure. So my Twitter is at watercastles, and come check me out. There's also a very good documentary that's out called Last Call at the Oasis. So if you're interested in learning more about how to conserve water across the entire world, check that documentary out, Last Call at the Oasis.
Also, in terms of plugging stuff, if you like us and you like our show, go to facebook.com/quarksandrec or quarksandrec.com or twitter.com/quarksandrec. Any one of those portals will get you to us. Feel free to leave us feedback, or if you have questions that you want answered on the show, send them our way. We're happy to do that. For our next podcast coming up, if you're interested, we're covering science behind superheroes. So a much more lighthearted topic than the end of the world. So how does that sound? Anyway, I think that'll do it for this show. So for Quarks and Recreation, I'm Doug.
I'm Brandon.
And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.